Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates episode by episode the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which aired on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fine Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, General Robert Iron Guts Kelly. And joining us this week in the VIP tent is Lieutenant Essie. Hi, Essie.
Hi. So glad to be here.
I'm so glad to have you. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
And thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So we're here to talk about the 15th episode of season 8. Yes, sir. That's Our Baby. Original air date, December 31st, 1979. So MASH really went out of the 70s with a really cheery episode for
so audiences. Happy.
Happy New Year, everybody.
Yay.
But we will get to all that in a moment. But of course, Essie, this is your first time on the show. So what's your MASH origin story?
I started watching MASH during college. I am still in college, but I started watching it last year fall, because we're now in 2026, and I started watching it in 2024. But it was a very stressful time in my life. So it what any reasonable person would do, and I started binging a show that is 50 years old.
Sure, of course.
I think I saw it on Tumblr. Yeah, I saw some MASH blog posts, and I was like, "That looked pretty gay. I should check it out."
That looked quite. That's a great quote. That looked pretty gay.
I should check it out. And it turned out to be more queer than I could thought, so it's a good decision.
There, and I mean, we'll get to it. There is a line in this episode that if you are of the bent, let's say, to find queer coding in MASH, there is a line that's just, you know, coals on the fire.
It's in my notes. It's probably in my notes.
I'm sure it is. I'm very excited to get to it. When I was rewatching this episode, I had forgotten that line was in there, and I was like, oh yeah, there's a MASH blur line if I ever heard one. But we'll talk about it. So it really was just you were looking for something to kind of occupy your brain a little bit, and Tumblr pointed you to MASH. It was that simple.
Yeah, and also because I'm pre-health, I want to get into the health field. So, and then I actually don't like to watch a lot of medical drama. I really don't like the whole style of like, we have a new case. This is so emergent. We need to do this ASAP. The patient's going to die. That's not my style. But MASH is so much not that. It's like, you know, there's politics, there's commentary, there's also, you know, your hospital episodes like OR, but they are done so well. And, you know, they give you the sense of urgency without over-dramatizing it, because, like, the drama is already inherent in the setting. So I appreciate that a lot, you know. And also the fact that, you know, we don't have what I consider stupid subplot, like, oh, this nurse is getting pregnant again. Oh, which love interest is our main guy going to get with? Like, no, get that out of here. I want to see life-saving stuff. I want to see gore. I want to see blood. And MASH delivered it.
See, now this show was waiting for you, right? Like, you know, the show was just sitting there like a mine in a minefield where it was like just waiting for you to come around and get of age. And there it is for you. It's perfect.
It's perfect.
No, when you started watching it, were your other friends like, were they like, what the hell are you, what is this thing?
So when I started watching it, and you know, I went crazy about MASH very early on. I think by like episode 3 or 4, definitely by 4, I was like full on MASH head. I had changed my phone wallpaper, my Tumblr profile pic, my Twitter profile pic, everything. I went in this so deep so quickly, and my friends are just staring at me like, a 15-year-old show already? And I'm like, you don't get it. It's good. Ever since then, in my friend group, I am known as the MASH person, and MASH is known as the Essie show.
Oh, that's wonderful. I love it. I absolutely love it. It's kind of funny to think that you were like all in by episode 4, and you're like, your friends are probably like, really? All right, how long is this going to last? And you're like, I got 247 more to go. You guys have no idea.
Especially because I always say, you know, whenever someone recommends me a TV show that, you know, sounds very good on paper, I have to warn them, like, I'm really like I find it really hard to get into new shows, especially long episode, like long seasons, a lot of episodes. Like I'm really bad with TV shows for this reason. I can't always sustain a hyperfixation long enough to finish it. I can't always find something interesting enough I want to watch it. And then I say all this and then I get into a show that runs for 11 years.
Now, have you finished it? Are you done?
Yes.
Oh, you have
I
finished it.
finished
Okay.
it in like 6 or 7 weeks. It was insane.
Wow.
Yeah. I will watch like 3 or 4 hours of MASH a day.
I hope that did not impact your studies.
No, surprisingly, I was still doing pretty good at school at that
Okay.
time.
All right. That's good. Well, that's absolutely terrific. That just makes me so happy. It really does to know that there are people out there that are just finding their way to it and going, what is this? And then just going all in. It's just such a wonderful, as someone that's been watching it my whole life, it's just great to hear. I love hearing those stories. So that's absolutely fantastic. Do you have a particular now, because now you've seen it all. Do you have a kind of particular favorite era? Is like the later ones, the middle ones, the early ones. Is there something you just, you're like, I like this a little more than this.
I think there are episodes in every season that I particularly love, but if I have to say that season by season, I think season 4 and season 8, this one is probably my favorite. I love when they do more serious episodes. I'm very much a drama person. I like when they do comedy, but it's done in such a way that you go, ha, what the fuck? And MASH in general does this very perfectly, but I think 4 and 8 just have some of my favorite episodes by far. Yes, sir, is probably one of my favorite episodes of all time.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's okay. That's a perfect segue. Let's get right to it then. As I mentioned, this episode aired on December 31st, 1979. It was written by it was written perfect episode to watch for your New Year's Eve party, everybody. It was written by Jim Mulligan and it was directed by Alan Alda. Hawkeye
Great
B.
omen.
Really seriously. Hawkeye, BJ, and Winchester are surprised to see someone has left a baby on the doorstep of the swamp with a note attached saying that its father is an American GI. The mother cannot care for the baby, so she's leaving it in the care of the doctors at the 477th. The baby quickly becomes the darling of everyone in camp, with everyone fighting to care for her. The only dark cloud is, ironically, when Father Mulcahy arrives from a day at the orphanage. He takes one look at the baby and realizes that she, being of mixed parentage, will be a virtual outcast among the other Korean children and could end up a virtual slave when she grows up. The only alternative, he says, is to deliver her to a monastery buried deep in the Korean hills, where the monks will take her, no questions asked, and in maybe 15 or 20 years, will try and get her out of Korea. Colonel Potter offers, "With all due respect, Padre, that's not much of a life." Mulcahy agrees, but says it's the only chance the baby has. Hawkeye and the rest can't accept this, and they decide that since the baby is half American, they're going to go through army channels. Unfortunately, Hawkeye and BJ are met with nothing but smug indifference from bureaucrat after bureaucrat, from the Red Cross to the Attorney General's office. Hawkeye and Colonel Potter then turn to the South Korean government, but the official they meet offers no help. He even admits that a mixed-race child is put into slavery and, in some cases, killed outright. As nightmarish as all this is, the man does point out that out of all the countries fighting in the Korean War, it is only the United States that does not accept the children of their soldiers and offer them a road to citizenship. Hawkeye, along with the Winchester, make one last try, this time with the U.S. diplomat. After endless interruptions showing the lack of attention he is giving their case, the diplomat blithely dismisses them, refusing to lift a finger to help this little girl. It drives Winchester mad, so mad that he offers to punch the man's lights out. With no other options, Hawkeye, BJ, Winchester, and Father Mulcahy drive to the monastery with the baby, leaving her inside a small alcove. They ring a bell, swinging the platform inside the building where the monks will greet it. They drive off. Later, during a session in OR, Hawkeye muses how much the child meant to them all and how each of them will carry that memory the rest of their lives. All right, Essie. I mean, what the MASH writers even said in later. With the benefit of hindsight, that they felt this was a flawed episode. I don't know if that was a quote from the writer Jim Mulligan, but the other people that worked on the show even said, yeah, that one didn't quite work the way we wanted it to, which I thought was, nice of them to be honest about, some of the things don't work on during 251 shows. They can't all be necessarily classics, but I'm curious. This was at the top of your list, so I'm curious, why did you want to talk about this one?
I want to talk about it because, I mean, first of all, it made me feral. I kind of finished the episode and I doubled over just, in pain. I want to scream in pain. So, that was fun. I must be a really fun episode to watch on your New Year's Eve party. Yay. But also the scene that really popped out to me is Hawkeye and Potter talking to the South Korean official, because there is a lot of nuances there that I feel a lot about it as well. I'm not a Korean, but I'm Chinese. I'm from Hong Kong, born and grew up there. So I think I do know a thing or two about growing up in a very racially homogenous society. I just feel a lot of thing about it, and I mean, in hindsight, I do think that maybe this is not a perfect episode, but I think they did what they wanted to do to the best of their abilities, and they did it much better than I would have otherwise expected from an American show. And honestly, I'm not confident if we try to do it in 2026, Hollywood would do a better job.
That's okay. That's an enormous compliment to pay the show. Yeah, I think that, like a lot of other episodes that actually we've talked about a few this season already, where I think that they had more story than could fit into 23, whatever it is, minutes, 24 minutes, but not enough for, like a double show, not enough for two episodes. So it feels a little truncated. And part of that is part of the reason I think this episode is a little unsatisfactory when you rewatch it, and it's not their fault, is that the ending is unsatisfactory. The end, that's the end. The story is unsatisfying because this child isn't given much of a way to escape the circumstances. And that's not the show's fault. The show is trying to realistically portray what it might be like for this situation. And I admire it that, as Larry Gilbart talked about, the show is not a smile button where they fix it all in the end and the baby is rescued and everything's going to be. No. That's it's so part of the reason I think this episode, when I watch it, is it leaves me feeling kind of sad, is because it's a sad episode. It just is. I mean, there's not any way around it.
Like, can you imagine watching it on your New Year's Eve party?
Yeah.
Can you? I watch it with a couple of friends when I was, rewatching it for this episode, and we just kind of sat in silence for a while, and then my friend was like, "That's a very good episode," but also like you can feel the mood. It's like, "Oh, damn!" Like, "Oh, damn!"
I think that anger is tricky when you're trying to sublimate it and kind of get that message, unless you're expressly just trying to let people know that you're angry. If you're trying to put like a layer of something else on top of it, it can be difficult because if you fail, the anger kind of bubbles to the surface a little bit. And I feel that this is obviously based on research that the MASH writers did, and this feels like the kind of thing where they discovered this, and the MASH writers were so incensed about what they learned that they just were burning to get this into an episode. And you can feel that kind of seething fury that they have about it, and that can make, again, I don't want to keep going on and on about this, but it can make it a little unpalatable, and it kind of reminds me of the there was. Forgive this digression, everybody. But many, many, many years ago, when I worked at a bookstore, we all had to go to this meeting and do this pretend thing because they were going to start. It was a bookstore. We were going to be selling Kindles. And I didn't want to sell Kindles. And I was mad about having to sell Kindles because I didn't want to be a salesperson. I wanted to be a bookstore clerk. And they made me come up and we had to do this little play act where I'm pretending to be a customer. Or I'm pretending to be an
Oh,
employee
God.
selling some. Yeah, it was all. And I don't like doing. I don't like being in front of people anyway, outside of a podcast microphone. And I was so angry about having to be there that I started to make it a joke. And it got a lot of laughs. And I thought it was sort of a way to diffuse the situation. And after it was over, people came up to me and said, "Dude, you're really angry." And
That's
I
very
didn't,
Hawkeye of you.
right? And I didn't know that. Like, I thought that I hid it. I thought that by making jokes, I was hiding the absolute. I don't know why I'm so mad about it, but I was. But I thought I hid it. And apparently I did not, because everybody picked up on it. And that made me feel uncomfortable that I'm like, oh, I didn't do that great a job. And so, yeah, it is a little Hawkeye-ish in that, like, oops. And so this episode really seeds with anger. Now, of course, there's some scenes where, like, we're talking about Winchester's literally going to
I
offer to
love that for him.
beat the shit out of the diplomat and stuff. So it's a unique episode for sure. You know, it stands apart as its own kind of thing, unlike anything they've ever done. So, okay, so let's talk about it. It opens up with the scene in the swamp where they hear the baby crying, and of course, BJ thinks he's back home, because he's like, "Peg, it's your turn to get Erin," because of course he's used to hearing a baby crying because he's wake up in the morning, and then it sort of wakes him up. He realizes where he is. He's in Korea, and Winchester is incensed because he thinks it's just some random baby that's on the camp. And then they realize, oh, wait a minute. And Winchester goes out and he finds the baby on literally the doorstep of the swamp. I love how much Charles softens when he
I
meets the
know.
baby. It's so sweet because he's so acerbic all the time. And I just love seeing this side of him, that he immediately is cooing and making the baby noises. I mean, he probably grew up with his sister, Honoria,
Yeah.
and they did mention that he had another sibling that died. So maybe he, and I don't think they ever established, I don't know if they remember saying, but he was the oldest. But he probably, certainly Honoria is younger than him. So maybe he's used to this a little, but I love that immediately that he is so good with this baby.
Charles definitely gives off like older brother vibes. He is definitely an older brother to me. And also, I just love that right off the bat, it just so quickly establishes like such a huge part of the comedy in the show, which is sorely needed, by the way. But it's so funny just seeing, Charles, the uppity officer, the uppity major that we've seen from season six onwards, just. He just dissolves into like a pile of softness the moment he sees the baby. And me and my friends are like, oh, like I love the characterization of it. I love the comedy of it. I just love everything that Theo S does. He's perfect.
It's
It's
really.
such the way he does like the comedic beat is so good. So good.
Yeah. I love, like I've said multiple times already, I love it when the three doctors are kind of all on the same page. Like they're not sniping at one another, and they're all immediately realizing the uniqueness of the situation. Of course, any TV show with a baby this young, has some level of verisimilitude because you can't tell the baby what to do. So I love that it's sitting on Mike Farrell's lap and it gets fascinated by his dog tags and it starts reaching out for them. And you see Mike Farrell lift up, or BJ, of course, lift up his dog tag and kind of hand it to the baby. And the baby's just sort of looking at it. And we see that Mike Farrell is obviously very, very good with this baby. And then the other part of it that I enjoy in terms of the realness of it is Hawkeye and Winchester are reading the note left. And I like that they partly can't read it because obviously the handwriting is probably very, very poor or just difficult to read. And I just like the I don't know, I like the realness of that, where he's at one point he's getting to a word and he kind of like pushes it over to Alan Alda, over to Hawkeye. I'm like, what? And then there's just something nice about that. It feels very real. That they're trying to kind of like, well, this is my baby, like that kind of thing, as opposed to just reading it very, very simply. So I love all. It's a great opening scene, and then we cut right to the mess tent, where of course, as you see, everybody is in love with the baby. We see Nurse Kelly from the background and all the other nurses, and then of course Margaret is glowing because we've seen Margaret is great with children, and they start arguing about who gets to take care of the baby. Klinger shows up with a glove. A surgical glove filled with milk, which they're going to use to feed the baby. And, Margaret says this looks ridiculous, and Potter's like, I don't know. I think it looks like the business end of a Guernsey. So, and they managed to prick a hole in it, and feed the kid that way. And so it's so, this episode is just so unique that we're seeing everybody looking so happy and so silly and goofy.
They're so happy. It's like I have so rarely seen the whole cast look so happy. I think like part of the draw of this episode is also like the beginning feels almost domestic. It's like this is a giant family and they're all taking care of the baby, and which is in and of itself kind of a fantasy, kind of a fantasy situation, but it's sweet. And also, I'm going to start overanalyzing, but something I love so much about this while breastfeeding is that it involves only the men. Like, actually, the whole episode has such an interesting way of like presenting gender, something that my non-binary friend picked up on as well. And I'm like, yeah, like it's like a breastfeeding scenario, but only the men are involved. Klinger is the one who came up with the idea of like inflating the glove. And then Potter gave it a try, and Hawkeye is the one who feeds the baby. Literally, no women are involved. Margaret is not involved. None of the nurses. It's like such a traditionally feminine task, and it's given to men. It tickles my brain so well.
It said it's, it's showing the men to be nurturing, and in a way that I, like I've mentioned in other episodes, I always found that to be, first of all, very unique and very, I felt like, yeah, that's sort of the men that I want to see. You can be
Yeah.
masculine, but you can also be nurturing. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing, it's not a slight on your manhood, for Pete's sakes, to be this way. And I love that they're all fighting over it. And then Winchester's like, I happen to be a fine, one of the finest pediatricians. I'm like, where's that coming from? He's not a pediatrician. That's a specialty. There is no way that Winchester specialized in, I'm sure he had to do some sort of rotation, but he's not an ex.
He's
He's
not.
not. Come on, he's making it up. And
He's not.
of course, BJ and Potter are the two with the most
Experiences.
experiences, because they both have children. So it's
Yeah.
like, I mean, BJ's like, bully on both of you. He's like, I'm the woman. They're like, yes, of course. Like, he would be better at that than anybody else, but okay. And so then Potter suggests that they give the kid a physical, and we Hawkeye is doing that in the I don't even know what exactly. I guess it's like the what office this is exactly. It's just one of like the random
Yeah.
off to the side rooms they have here. And Klinger shows up with a tiny shirt to give the kid. And I will say, not to, I don't ever want to rewrite shows for the MASH writers, because what the hell do I know? But they really missed a good chance at a radar joke,
Oh
to
my
say, oh,
God,
this is Ray, run of
yeah.
radar shirts got left behind. It's where it
Like
fits the
just one
baby.
of his shirt got left behind, like mixed up with the laundry, and like, oh,
Yeah.
that's radar. That would be so funny as well. I love that for you.
I was like, oh well, okay. That's what can you do? So, and we see everyone here is just really glowing, right? All the actors look like they're just, and again, the reality of they have a baby on the
It's so
set.
sweet.
This is something none of them have, other than one or two other episodes in season two with the Kim episode, and even then, Kim was not a tiny, tiny little baby. Generally, you didn't have babies on the set of MASH. So they all just, Jamie Farr, they all just look like they are just so happy to be dealing with this little kid.
And the little kid is just doing nothing. You know, she's just, you know, eating her own finger and looking at them with her big little eye. You can hear it in my voice. I'm getting affected just thinking about the scene. Like, that is such a cute baby. Like, I understand them 200%. Like, if I see a baby who is not my own baby, meaning I don't have to take care of it like 24/7, I would also quit it. Like, oh my God. Especially like in a war zone. Like what they see most of the time is dying people, you know, dying adults, and you know, sometimes in sad episodes, dying kids. But you know, a baby who is healthy, and she's here not because, you know, of some tragic infant disease, but you know, because someone who loved her left her on their doorstep so that, you know, she could have a better life. It's such a sweet situation. Oh my God.
I remember in the final episode, when one of the when they do the whole "What are you all going to be doing when this is over?" One of the nurses even says, "I want to work in pediatrics." Because I want to, after seeing all this death, I want to start bringing people into the world, which I thought was such a nice turn of phrase, right? To say I've spent so much time at the one end of life's existence, I want to hit there at the beginning.
And coincidentally, my first thought when I finished the finale is, with what happened to Hawkeye is I'm never going to be able to watch Yessir the same way again.
Yeah, that's true. So Margaret demands that Klinger hand over the baby, and he doesn't want to. And she literally orders him. Klinger has a great line where he's like, it's enough to make someone want to go to officers' candidate school, which is
Klinger, present baby. That was so funny.
Now she's got, and of course, of all the tents for the baby to live in, Margaret is definitely going to be one of the nicer ones. I mean, they've already established the swamp is filthy, so
It's
it's
the
not.
swamp.
It's literally called a swamp. It's not a great place for a baby. And I love she calls herself, she says, I'm your Auntie Margaret. And again, it's just wonderful to see her, and they're all like, oh, Margaret, this is so wonderful. They're kind of making fun of her a little bit, because, not making fun of her, but they're calling it out that she's so, after her being kind of so strong and so tough, that she melts with this baby. But again, as we've seen in previous episodes, she loves kids. She's great with kids. She makes it a special case to take care of the kids. Even Frank Burns was mean to kids, but she wasn't. She was mean to kids. So she then brings the kid into her tent, and she's made a crib out of her Foot Locker, which we'll get to. There's a whole storyline this season about her Foot Locker, but here are the kids in the Foot Locker. Then Mulcahy arrives, and he's like, I've been hearing what's going on. And then he says, like orphanages and Irish families, there's always room for one more. And then he looks down and they say, isn't she lovely? And he goes, yes, quite nice. And they're all like a little confused, right? Hawkeye's like, what? Like, what? What's going on? And then that's when the dark cloud arrives, of Father Mulcahy explaining what is going on. And boy, howdy, does he get dark.
It
Right?
does.
Like really fast. He gets into how brutal it is for these kids' lives. And I mean, it's
It's
kind of what we were,
depressing.
yeah. And what we were kind of talking about just a second ago, that like we're seeing everybody so bright and cheery. And then the one guy who's usually the most cheery is the worst. Like he comes in and he's this black cloud. So again, it's just a nice change up for what we're usually getting out of a MASH episode.
Yeah, I think it's definitely such a MASH way of doing Whiplash as well. It's one of MASH's strengths, I think. Again, just the way they can handle the Whiplash from, oh, look at this, happy, funny thing, ending very quickly to actually the reality is horrible. And I actually tried to read up a bit just to see if what Mulcahy and the episode's writer is right, and it is, which is depressing. Everything I read about how American kids are treated, in Korean War and post-Korean War is just depressing. It is true. And it's like, oh, this is the one case where I wish they exaggerated it.
It's rough. It's, I mean, he watching it over again, he goes so hard, so fast. I mean, saying this child has no future, none. And he talks about that little girls are killed outright. And again, you just have to think that, like, this is people watching. I mean, at this point, MASH was, like the number three or number four show on television. So it was massively popular. You're talking back then, those numbers meant that's 20 million people watching an episode. So this is, people know what they're getting out of MASH. But at the same time, it is a sitcom. And to hear this kind of, such unvarnished doomerism kind of from Father Mulcahy. And again, it's, as you just talked about, it's real, but you're just, I'm trying to imagine what it would be like to sitting in your easy chair in
New Year's Eve.
1979, New Year's Eve, 1979, and hearing this. And he immediately goes to the talk about the monastery. And I like that when he gives him the reality. And then I like that Father Mulcahy's, or excuse me, Potter is like,
That's not much of a
that's
life.
not much of a life. And he's like, well, that's the best we can do. And Hawkeye says, well, she's half American. We'll get her a ticket to the Statue of Liberty. And In another instance of it flipping your expectations, here's Hawkeye being Captain Patriotic and Captain Optimist,
Optimistic.
right?
It's so painful.
I mean, you're not expecting that out of Hawkeye. Hawkeye is like, I'm going to go deal with the US government and it's all going to go great. And it's like, that is so not what you expect out of Hawkeye Pierce. So they just keep flipping things back and forth. So the show is still really sad, but it's better written than you might think because of its sort of unsatisfactory ending. But just the idea of just how much they are pulling the rug out from our characters.
And especially like it is in a way, I think it's set up with the jokes earlier too, because earlier like a big part of the comedy is about how like the main cast would dote on the baby so much that they would go opposite of what they usually do, like how Charles normally is so tough and no nonsense but goes so soft when it comes to the baby, how Margaret would normally flip off at anyone who steals her clothes like that, but she's like, oh, for the baby, I could I could sleep in whatever.
Right, it's just my
And
pajama bottoms.
and in this case you have, in a more serious sense, Hawkeye being so optimistic and like, yeah, I'll go talk to the US Army, it'll go great. It's just another case of the baby bringing out a side of them that maybe they don't even expect of themselves previously, but in a more serious situation.
So Hawkeye and BJ put on their dress uniforms and they go visit the Red Cross. We meet the Red Cross representative. Her name is Harper, played by the actress Elizabeth Farley. She was in movies like Audrey Rose, which is a horror movie, Chapter Two, which is a Neil Simon movie, Some Kind of Hero with Richard Pryor and Margot Kidder. And she's plying them with donuts. And there's a line about, she's like, you guys want another donut? And I think BJ's like, no, five's my limit. And she just says, we have no responsibility. It's out of our hands. We have enough trouble dealing with the people we're responsible for. Like, she's not, oh boy.
We
Now,
have enough trouble. That's your job as the Red Cross.
They really don't, again, I think it's because the show is, it's got to get its point across in 23
And
minutes.
also, it's so angry.
Yes, right,
Everyone is
exactly.
big
Like,
mad.
Every representative that they're going to meet is about the worst case example, and they get worse. She's the best one of the three they're going to meet in terms of how dismissive they are of it. And then she even says, I think what you're trying to do is admirable, naive, but admirable. And it's just such a dismissive, patronizing tone.
Yeah, I think you're naive. Like, oh my God.
You know, it's like the kid is the child of a soldier. Why would we, why is this such a ridiculous idea here that we've come up with, that this child might need to be sent to sent back sent back sent not back sent to America. So then we're back at the 477th, and Klinger is explaining what a popo is, which is a thing from his culture where it's basically just a diaper, and he's showing how it fits on the baby and it fits snugs on over the legs and hips. Now, do you have a lot of experience with putting diapers on children? Do you have any younger
Absolutely
siblings?
not.
Okay.
Absolutely not. I was an only child, and then my mom doesn't even like children in particular. So, like when I grew up a bit more, and then she's like, "Do not have kids. Do not have kids."
Wow. Thanks, Mom.
She has a philosophy that is like, it is fun to play with babies as long as they're not your own. Because if they start crying, you can shove them back to their parents. But you can't shove them back to yourself if you're the parent. So,
Wow.
babies are fun for a while, but they're more fun if they're not your own. And I agree with that 100%. I have never changed a single diaper in my life.
Okay. I don't have children, so I don't have a lot of experience with it. I did have a goddaughter who and I was around for from her birth early on, so I did change a bunch of those diapers. And I babysat a couple of times, and my friend was just like, just keep her alive. That's it. That's all. It's pass fail. Just keep her alive. When we come home, is she alive? Yeah, you did well.
Good
Okay, great.
job.
So I don't have a lot of experience either. That was 20, 25 years ago for Pete's sake. So Klinger gets very romantic about babies, and he talks about that he wants to maybe go home, and he's like, he'll learn to trade for the GI Bill, and he'll have a family. And now he initially is like, I love children, but it'll be a boy, because he can take the kid to Mud Hens games, shoot a rack of eight ball with, go bowling. And he's being very sort of, you know, to use a modern phrase, gender normative, of kind of like, oh, well, you know, I'm only do boys. But then he softens and he says, then again, I could get very attached to a little girl. And he's like, I got a Foot Locker full of hand-me-downs. And of course, any kid that is going to be the child of Max Klinger is going to Mudhead games, no matter what sex the child
Even
is.
if he has a daughter, he's going to bring her to Mudhen Games. Anyway,
Yeah.
that girl's gonna grow up going to Mudhen Games.
Yeah. That kid will be a tomboy for sure. And in all the best ways, right? Because it's just like Klinger. I'm betting Klinger would be an absolutely marvelous father, very warm-hearted and understanding,
He's going to be
and
such a fantastic father.
yeah. So then we're back at the army office, and we meet Spectre, played by actor Howard Platt, in a ton of movies. He's one of those guys who, you know, was always like 17th billed, but is in a ton of movies. He was in The Rock, he was in Westworld, he was in Oliver Stone's Nixon. He's also in The Cat from Outer Space with Harry Morgan and McLean Stevenson, which we talked about on MASHcast a bunch of years ago. And he isn't so much saying no as he is drowning Hawkeye and BJ in paperwork. And it's all these forms. And he says, this is the disposition form. And BJ is like, is this a good disposition form or a bad disposition form? And he's so talking about how many different steps it's got to go through, a history of all the involved parties, a letter from the chaplain, all this stuff. And then he says, and then after all that, and they say, oh, God gets it. And then
No.
he says, no, I-Corps. And he's like, and then BJ's like, same thing. And and then they leads to the mash blur line. So why don't you explain to everybody what that line is?
It's probably, it's probably Hawkeye going over and say, say for the fun of it, we want to adopt. Our doctors told us we can't have kids of our own. And I can just already hear the MASH blur crowd, especially the Beach Hawk shippers going insane at it. Like, okay, when can I hear the wedding bells? Should I send a letter to Peg apologizing in advance? I'm sorry, Peg.
Things have changed here when I was in Korea. Yeah, that is just such mash blur catnip, that line. And again, it's
It's funny.
But growing up as a when I did growing up when I did in the 70s and 80s, and again, I hear myself crumbling to dust as we're talking, but growing up when I did, you didn't hear men talk like that. That was not considered something that you could put in the mouths of your male characters and have them appear manly. But the fact that they could make that joke and deliver it with such aplomb of like, you know, the doctor told us we couldn't have children of our own. It just rolls right off the tongue, you know? And it's
They
just,
say
I
it
love
so
it.
casually.
Yes. I love it. I love it.
I
It's
love
just such,
it.
it's a great laugh line. It's a great laugh line. And then they finally say, look, even if we do all that, we go through all these forms, how do we get this kid over to America? And the guy goes, how about parcel post?
Oh God, I want to punch him in the face. He is such a good actor because he makes me want to punch his face the entire scene. I hate him so much. In my notes, like when I finished the scene, I just wrote the banality of evil. He reminds me so much of that idea. Just the idea of like not saying no directly, but like technically you can do that, but you just have to fill out like 500 paperworks.
Yeah. I can bury this atrocity in jargon and red tape, so I don't really have to have my fingerprints on it. I don't have to really confront the moral, you know, the moral
Wait.
degeneracy of what I'm saying, and I can just say, well, those are the rules, you know. And he is very blithe, and he even, you know, he refers to we're not responsible for when a soldier gets lonely, and he
Oh,
kind of just,
God.
you know, he just sort of sneers when he says that. And then to make it even worse, he says, "Why the hell are you two so steamed up over some kid anyway? Is one of you guys the
The
daddy?"
daddy. Oh, I hate that whole so much. I hate it for so many reasons. It's just, I mean, first of all, what soldiers do when they're lonely is such a dehumanizing way to refer to Korean women.
Yeah.
They don't, what they do when they're lonely should refer to things like, I don't know, playing kickball, playing Xbox if you're in the modern times, not having sex with women. That is
Yeah.
an activity you do with someone else. And he just removes those women from narratives so easily.
Yeah.
And it's like, and also because I hate it, because like what soldiers do when they're lonely is just such an excuse for exploiting women. Like in the most extreme cases, you know, that excuse is what the Japanese Imperial Army used to justify their system of mass sexual slavery. And even in the Korean War, there are camped down sex workers. And funnily enough, actually, I found out while I was searching online, Koreans call women in both cases comfort women. So, you know, the exploitation that the US did to them is not so different from what the Japanese did in World War II. Really makes you think about how good the US is in this case.
Yeah, it's a tough scene. And then when he says that, BJ says it's a good thing we're doctors. And then they both stand up and they say, BJ says, "'Cause I'm going to break every bone in your body."
I support him. I support him. Go break
Yeah.
those bones.
I will say, I know I go on and on about this, but when this episode aired in my local syndication market, they literally cut to commercial in the middle of BJ talking. That's like they cut the line, like they faded it
Oh.
2 seconds early. So he's like, "Good thing we're doctors, because I'm gonna br—" and then they go to commercial. What? He couldn't
Your
leave it.
anger
It's
is
two
just so
one other
much that, oh
second.
my God, oh my God, we cannot imply that it is, you know, it can ever be morally correct to punch an army official. Blur it up, blur it out.
Yeah, it's oof. So that's our act break, and then we come back, and everybody but Mulcahy is again sitting around this barrel that's been cut in half that they've turned into a rocker for the baby, and Potter is rocking it with a stick. Now there's an interesting comment where Hawkeye says, "Klinger, my compliments to Zale on making that cradle." Well, we'll never see Zale again. It's interesting that they didn't sort of, I guess, because we know from this season that in the Yellow Brick Road episode, which has already happened, Rizzo has been established as a new character. But they must have not quite, or maybe this one was done before that one, or they just didn't know that Rizzo was going to be an ongoing, that he's going to be the replacement Zale. So as of this point, Zale is officially still at the 4077. We just never see him again. It does
It's
make me
mash
wonder,
time.
it's MASH time, yes. How did they do this? What tool is at the 4077 that it could cut a metal barrel in half? I don't know how would you get that done?
I don't know. I don't know. Zale must have had some wizardry about this. How do you cut a barrel in half? I am a nerd and I don't know the
Yeah,
answer.
I mean it's not like they have some. It's not like they have a
Metal
bandsaw
working
or a metal
tool?
working. And the cut is really well done. I mean, you see it;
Neat.
it's very, very neat. So yeah,
It's
it's not.
way down exactly half.
Yeah, it really is. So Zale really did do quite a good job. So I like that as they're talking about it, Potter's getting angrier and angrier, and he's rocking the baby, and he's gonna shoot the kid out of the barrel
And
because
everyone's
he's
like,
rocking it so
Colonel,
hard.
the baby.
Yeah, he's like, "I know." And then he says, "Threatening to file the AG's top eight under D for deceased is not your everyday howdy-do."
Love it so much. I love that for them. I love that for them.
So then finally, Winchester says, "Look, let me, you know, let me be the one that does this." Or he's like, "Let me get involved in this." And Potter goes, No, I'm going to go with Hawkeye to the next place, the next office. I don't know, blank on that word, the next office to see what we can do." And that's when we meet the head of the South Korean government, and this is played by actor Yuki Shimoda. He was born in 1921, passed away in 1981. He is the main character from the episode The Price from season
Oh.
seven. Yeah, he's the same actor. And this is, I think, you don't have it in my notes, but I'm pretty sure this is like the last thing he ever did. He did one more MASH
Oh.
after this, and that was it. But like his last couple credits are just these MASH episodes, because I said he passed away in 1981. And we see this office here. By the way, they spent a lot of money on this episode, because we see four
A
separate
lot of
new
locations.
sets. I mean, yeah, they're just redressed, but nevertheless, they're well appointed and they look real. So they spent a lot of money on this episode. And he is gently talking to Hawkeye and Potter. And Potter says, "What about the stories we hear about mutilating babies and killing them?" And then he says, "Sadly, Colonel, in some cases they are true." And then Hawkeye has a line that's a little uncomfortable coming out of the mouth of our hero, where he says, "My God, what kind of place is this?"
Honestly, as an East Asian who was born and grew up in East Asia, I would not blame his sentiment, but I think it's a bit different because he is a white American and I'm not. But also, yeah, I think this is, and we will see this in the entire scene, but I think this is why, MASH cannot handle this topic so well because it is a topic that I don't think a lot of white Americans can handle carefully. Yeah, because it can go so easily into like, oh, look at these people of color, they're such savages. It can go so easily into this narrative. But also, like, on the other hand, if you talk about it too little, then you risk whitewashing, ironically, the xenophobia and cruelty that people of color are also capable of. I just think it's not a topic that white people can talk about very well.
It's a net. You can understand Hawkeye's reaction, but it's the way he says it. It is just, you kind of set you back a little, that you're like, wow, okay. And then this guy Chung Ho Kim sort of drops this sort of bomb on them all, where he says, "Well, we're not the only country that does things like this." And then Hawkeye's like, "Well, who are we talking about? Bolivia?" And then he says, "No, Captain, you're United States. Americans are not the only ones fathering such children, but they are the only country who ignore them." And he says, "France, Great Britain, the Netherlands, they acknowledge a responsibility for these unfortunate babies of their military, and they offer them support, and some will offer support and help them, some will offer citizenship. But the United States," he says, "where all men are created equal, refuses to do this. You reject the children of your own people." And the way that that actor Yuki Shimoda delivers that line is
Beautiful.
beautiful. I guess that's the word, right? It's sad. And the episode, when I've seen it in syndication, cuts right from there. Like, as soon as he's done talking, it cuts. The full episode, when you watch it, on the DVDs or whatever, it holds on this scene, and there's no audio except the clock ticking. And it's a nice touch, and I'm frustrated that the version I always saw cut that, because I'm sure the editor was like, "Oh, there's nothing happening, cut it." But it's letting this scene sit there for a moment of like, well, what else is there to say now that the United States doesn't even do this?
And I think in a way, like looking at the whole scene, like I'm not going to say that Hawkeye's comment is comfortable because I don't think it is, but I do think that it is so necessary for the setup because it plants the idea into your head that like this is like this rejection of your own people's child is something so barbaric that no civilized people should be able to do just for the bomb of like, but you're doing exactly that to land right there. And it's like it's an uncomfortable moment. I don't like it per se, but I do think this scene is not bad. It's handled not bad. This is it's I like that they the focus is mostly on critiquing how the American people handle this, because this is something that MASH and its cast and crew can do comfortably. It's just depressing.
Yeah, it
Yeah.
is. It is. And we're not 40 years past this episode. We're not any better at talking
Yeah.
about any of these issues. We're just not. And it's I don't know why some people are just so focused on this stuff. I don't understand it. And this is not the place to have this discussion or whatever, but it's just sad to think that there is just a chunk of people to whom the color of your skin or your where the hunk of land on the planet you happen to be born in should make such a big difference. Yeah, so we're back at the 477th, and they're trying to talk about what else to do, where else to go. There's a line that's kind of weird where Potter wants to go to another office, and then he says to Hawkeye, "Pierce, you've been toting this banner higher than anyone." No, he hasn't. No, yeah, like what
Everyone
is
is in this
what
together.
that?
Everyone is in this together. You went to talk to the South Korean government yourself just one scene earlier, Paula.
Yeah, that's just one of those. I'm sure the writers were given directives of, yes, the cast is an ensemble,
But
but
also, Hawkeye's the
Hawkeye
main
is first
guy.
among equals, so you got it. But I mean, if I was BJ, I'd be like, hey,
Hey.
what is that about? So Potter then says, "Well, look, you're packing way too much anger." So he's like, "I'm going to bring someone along with me." And he says, "The kind of person who speaks fluent hoi polloi," which is funny because that's actually incorrect. Hoi polloi is the term for the common man. It is not hoi polloi is not mean you speak the upper
Fluent.
crust. It's
Oh.
the actual opposite of that. But it's okay. Potter doesn't necessarily know
Yeah.
that. But of course, we all know who he's talking about. He's talking about Winchester. And then we find Winchester and Hawkeye in this guy Prescott's office. This Prescott is played by an actor named William Bogart. He has been in 40 million things. He was born in 1936, passed away in 2020. He was in movies like War Games, Dog Day Afternoon, Heaven Can Wait. And then actually, he played kind of a generic white guy on Chappelle's Show, a bunch of episodes when they needed like a clueless white guy. They called him to do it. So he had a really good career.
Really?
I remember him when I watched Chappelle's Show when it was on, and he would show up, and I'm like, I remember that guy from that episode of
From
MASH.
MASH.
He was always that guy.
Generic white guy is so funny.
Now, he's. I said earlier that these scenes escalate in their awfulness, but they kind of don't. The one with
The
BJ
Specker?
and Hawkeye, that's the worst one. This
That's the worst.
Prescott is just clueless and not taking it seriously, but he's not as sneering and snide as the other guy.
Yeah.
Except until so they get to the end where Winchester is trying to get him to pay attention, and then finally. He dismisses, he says, no. The guy he says, no, there's nothing we can do. And he says, and he calls it an undetected juvenile with no relative in the United States. Again, it's all getting locked down in jargon, right? It's all just
Yeah.
getting turned into, and then Hawkeye even says, this child you're so blithely dismissing could conceivably be murdered in the name of racial purity. Again, that's a phrase appearing on national television at like 8:30 at night. Racial purity that jumps out at you, and then that leads Winchester to get even more mad. And I love the bit where the phone rings because it's like his
Yeah.
secretary, and he says, "Let them eat out," and he hangs up on them. And then he says, "You're condemning this child to a life of misery, and you're worried about your stupid seating arrangements." And then he even tells Hawkeye, "Shut up, Pierce," which he's so mad. And then he calls him a smarmy bureaucratic microbe. You're about to go to that dinner breathing through your fly.
And he
And
lunges at him. And then Hawkeye has to hold him back, like, the boar is wild. I love that moment so much. It is probably one of my favorite Charles moment ever.
he gets so red-faced. David Ogden Stiers, when he gets mad, gets like red as a beet.
Yeah.
Which is fun. His hair kind of poofs out on the side a little. So it's this show is very not funny on purpose, and they're doing their best to inject
Some
any bit of
humor.
levity, any sort of levity in this, because so yeah, and so David Ogden-Titus really kind of like goes up to 11 doing the chasing after Bogart, and then we're back to the 477th, and we see obviously the discussion has been had. The child is going to go to the orphanage, and the Jeep has got it's Winchester, Hawkeye, BJ, and Mulcahy, and Margaret doesn't want to hand the kid over, and then they do, and Hawkeye says, "All right, Beach, let's go, and don't hurry." And so they get there, and again, another set, yet another new set. I mean, I'm sure again, it's the brush set that they've had, but it's they've had to dress it up a little. And there's this great moment where they get out of the Jeep, and Mulcahy starts going on this long story about the history of the place, about its history and its traditions, and BJ interrupts him very snappily and just goes, "All right, let's just do it." And I love that. I like that moment. I love that BJ is like, I don't give a shit.
Yeah,
I don't
I
want to
don't
hear
give a
this
shit
history
about your
lesson.
tradition.
Yeah. He's pissed off. He's really pissed off. And
Understandable.
they're very rarely snippy towards Mulcahy. That almost
Yeah.
never happens. But I just think that's such a great, just a great moment of BJ just being, "Let's just do it, all right."
Also, it pairs so well to a period of adjustment because we've already seen, BJ blowing up and being really angry. We've seen his anger issues.
He's capable of it for sure.
Yeah.
So then they're saying goodbye to all the they're all saying goodbye to the kid. And again, another bit of, verisimilitude that this is a baby and you can't tell the baby what to do while they're trying to have this very delicate, serious scene. The kid is fascinated by Alan Alda's nose.
Oh, it just makes it hurt more for me because it's like the baby is clueless and he obviously, like the baby in the story, obviously likes the MASH people. She's
Yeah.
she played with BJ's toe tags. She's
Yep.
played with Hawkeye's nose. It is so like the innocent is just the innocent contrast, this harsh reality so much. It makes it hurt so much. The baby made acting choices. I don't care if she's a baby. She made acting choices. I hate her for this choice. It hurts.
I have to wonder how many takes they did of this, that they were able to kind of get through it. And Hawkeye has this nice scene where he says, "You brought a lot of light to a dark and dismal place." And, at the risk of overanalyzing it, but that's why we're here, is after Mulcahy blesses the baby, he turns around and he's ready to put the kid in front of the little, I don't know, whatever the little
Cradle.
dumb waiter thing that they've got. And he says, "You brought a little light to a dark and dismal place." But then they have this very awkward cut to Winchester by himself looking at Hawkeye. And if you watch closely, you can see that the shot of Winchester is actually a little bit out of focus. And I wonder if that isn't a shot from for some reason, there was something with the scene that got ruined. And they had to cover it, and so they grabbed the still from another scene, and they blew and they maybe I maybe it was a scene with Hawkeye, and they had to crop him out of the frame, so they had to blow it up. It's just a very strange moment that as Hawkeye is giving this beautiful speech to this baby, they cut to Winchester just sort of standing there, and I have to wonder if that's just a little bit of editing trickery because then they cut back to Hawkeye
Yeah.
in the middle of the speech saying, "You'll never know what you've meant to a bunch of tired people stuck in a very strange time."
I mean, I'm going to overanalyze and say that, I don't know, something about, bringing a bit of light to people stuck in such a dark place and then cutting it to Charles, the most recent addition, the one guy, one of the two new additions, I'm saying this with like parentheses, that, we saw your throw up on screen being so unused initially to MASH. And then, we also see Charles, 180% degree personality change with the baby. I don't know where I'm leading with this either, but something about Charles showing so much softness to the baby paired with Hawkeye's dialogue. Something about it is, tinkling in my brain.
Mm.
I don't think it's a good cut. I mean, it's a very awkward cut,
Yeah.
but I'm going to overanalyze my way into making it make sense.
Okay. Hey, however you get there, I mean, it doesn't bother me. It's not like, oh, that's
Yeah,
wrong. It
it's
just looks
just
a little
funny.
strange. It just looks a
Yeah.
little like, why, what a
It's like
strange
such
cut.
a sudden drop in the picture quality when I was watching it on Hulu.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a little odd. So, and then they put the kid in the little barrel and they turn it around and they ring the bell and they don't talk. They all just walk into
The
the Jeep,
silence.
they just get into the Jeep, and that's the end of the main part of the episode. And then we come back, and this scene is the one scene that I would argue would be like doesn't really work because they're in the middle of surgery, and just kind of out of nowhere,
Yeah.
Hawkeye talks about how they're all gonna, the kid brought all we do here is fight pain and death, and suddenly we had a small life, and we're all gonna be carrying a little bit of this kid with us wherever we go. And no one says anything. It's an odd setting
It's a bit
to have it
redundant.
during surgery. I think why maybe have them sitting at the O Club or in the mess tent. It just was a little like, huh, okay. And I almost wonder, like, they didn't know how to get out of it. They didn't know what to wrap it up with, so they kind of did this awkward
Yeah.
scene, and that's the end of the episode.
I actually think this episode is like, it would be better without Tag. Because because if you end with them leaving the monastery, would it be awkward? Yes. Would it be really sad? Yes. But also let the silence hang. This is a sad situation, and I don't think there's any way you can do to make it happier. I don't think there's
Yeah.
much you can do to, go back to, hey, let's go back to sitcom land. When
Right.
I let me I forgot what the tag for this episode was. So when I was rewatching it, I kept expecting the tag to be something funny because that's the normal sitcom logic.
Yeah.
But I think, the tag is just a bit, it's just restating what we already saw. Like,
Yeah.
it's already shown to us. You don't need to say it again. This is
Yeah.
like one of those essay conclusions where it's like, in conclusion, I think one, two, three, where you just, repeat the topic sentence of each body paragraph.
Yeah. I mean, if you really want to like kick people in the pants, have the final scene be like, Margaret going back to her tent and like
Oh
they're
no.
the Foot Locker's empty, so
Oh
just if
God.
you really want to be cruel to people or do something like with the Goodbye
I'm so
Radar where
glad
they
you
go
are
back
not
to the
on.
swamp,
I'm so glad you are not a MASH writer. Horrible thought. Delete it.
Sending people off to the next show, whatever followed MASH on Monday nights, but yeah, I mean it's not a big deal. It's just a little awkward. Now I found this piece of trivia on the IMDb page for this episode, and you can never trust IMDb trivia because a lot of it is written by completely insane people. But nevertheless, we'll make of this what you will, everybody. This I read this. So it says when talking to army officials, Hawkeye references MacArthur as the commander in Korea, dating this MASH from the latter half of 1950 to April 1951 when MacArthur was fired. Now, of course, MacArthur had already been fired on MASH in like season four, but nevertheless. Yet, Father Mulcahy speaks of the life of mixed children of American servicemen and Korean women. He speaks not only of what kind of life such children have in orphanages, but also how Koreans treat these children as they grow up and how they will be ostracized by every segment of Korean society. Mulcahy's speech is clearly written with the hindsight of the writers in 1979. But in early 1951, no biracial children will have had a chance to experience any such treatment. All such children in 1951 would have been less than a year old and certainly would not have come close to being grown up yet. So.
Maybe,
Maybe.
but it's like, does it really matter? Does it really,
No.
I mean, would this piece of realism make the episode better or would it make it worse?
Yeah, it doesn't. It doesn't really. Anyone watching this knows the show was made in 1979, and it's like, okay, it's fine.
And
I just
also
thought that
with,
was interesting, an observation to make that, okay.
okay.
But.
Also, the show is about the Vietnam War, in a way. And yeah.
And it is trying to. By presenting the issue, you are trying to maybe get people to think differently about it and maybe make it better and suggest to people that maybe we shouldn't be so stingy about these kinds of that's a too light a word for such a thing. We should be so cruel about offering citizenship to the children that
That you're
are
responsible
that
for.
we're responsible for. We're sending these troops overseas, and they're making babies, and we should be offering them citizenship because they are the children of our citizens. So, all points to MASH for tackling this subject. They did it in other episodes in the General's Practitioner in season five. Mulligan, ironically, this episode is
Oh,
written by
yeah.
Jim Mulligan, and then the character in that episode is Mulligan. He's
Oh.
got a wife and a Korean baby, and he just goes, "Well, I guess we're going off to Bitter Creek," and that's the sum total of the discussion of that. And it's like, well, I think there's going to be a lot more to it, but they didn't want to deal with that. That's not what that episode's about. So, and then there's the they talk in the Kim episode where Trapper is going to adopt Kim. They talk about how complicated it is, but they do kind of act as though, oh, this is going to go through no problem. So it's this is them taking taking this topic much more seriously and presenting it in a way that's not fun, not terribly satisfying in a lot of ways. And so again, points to them for giving it a shot.
Yeah, again, I think they did the best that they could. You know, it's the whole thing with like East Asian racial purity, the whole thing, that's not something they can talk about. But I appreciate that they focus so much on how Americans treat American children, especially because when you consider, like issues of like consent between American GIs and Korean women who are sex workers, then it just becomes even more America's responsibility to take care of these children, and then they don't.
Yeah. By the way, to end this on a goofier note, but I couldn't help but think about that. Whoever this baby is, that kid is like 47 now. And
Yeah.
if I had been on an episode of MASH when I was a baby, you'd never hear me stop talking
Hey.
about it, right?
That was me as a baby. That was me playing with Alan Alda's nose. It's in history forever.
I would never shut up about it. I'd be like, did I ever tell you that I was? Yes, you've told me.
Every single Friday night where we go on to happy hour. Yes, you did.
Yeah, I mean, right. So there is some 47-year-old out there somewhere that was like, oh yeah, I was the centerpiece of an episode of MASH.
And everyone thought I was very cute.
I had scenes with every cast member. I'm in every scene practically, So okay, so that is yes, sir. That's our baby. So this might be a tough mission here, but nevertheless, do you have a favorite line or joke from this episode, Essie?
I would say one of my favorite line is definitely Father D and the Deceased. That was so funny. It was just like the way that, we only see him via Potter, the way that we don't even hear him say it, you can just imagine how mad they are. And also, the whole, good thing we're doctors, because I'm about to break every bone in your body. And I'm like, hell yeah. Hell yeah, I support you, BJ. I support you. Go break that nose. It was just, I think it was the way that Mike Farrell says it. It's like he's smiling, but he is seething while smiling. And it's just, I think, and then Hawkeye also does this very similar smile later when he was with Charles and Bogart. Just, this angry smile is just like, I'm about to break every bone in your body. And it's terrifying, it's funny. I think it is such a good delivery.
Yeah, I do like the D for DCs because, as you say, like you didn't hear them say it. So and it's funny to like issue a threat in such a funny way, right? To say it in such a goofy, I'm going to file you under D under DC, but nevertheless, you are threatening to beat somebody up till they die, which is good.
Also, I was looking back at my notes and there was another line that I really like, and that was Potter talking about the child. She may have been abandoned, but she wasn't neglected. Like,
That is a nice line.
that is, I think that is, like, it's very understated, but I appreciate it a lot because it shows that the Korean mother herself cared very deeply for the child. Like, the mother herself was never on screen. But I think you can just imagine the pain that she went through to have to give her child away, and especially versus, when you think about it, the father was never mentioned at all. like maybe his identity wasn't even known. But what we know is that the Korean mother cared. You know, she cared enough that she wanted her kid to have a better future. And so she left it in a mash. And the baby was well loved in the mash. And it's like, oh, it's like, you know, they went through it all and they couldn't give a better life for the child. But it's like, it mattered they tried. And it mattered that the mom cared so much. It's so understated, but it was so sweet and it makes it so sad.
Yeah, I mean it's a way to, I think, absolve the audience if they have an anxiety that you might, some people in the audience might resent the mother character, even though, as you say, you don't see her. But that's a way of, letting the audience know that it's like, okay, yeah, that you this mother has been forced to do something that most people would find completely abhorrent. But the kid was not, the kid is well cared for, is well fed, as much as a kid in a war zone can be well fed. But that line, I think, is to there, like, you don't dislike the mother, right? You're just like, okay, this poor woman was forced into an absolutely untenable situation, and this is what she did, and she did the best version of an awful thing that she did, which was leave it at the doorstep of the swamp. And if we want to overanalyze it, which is, again, what we're here to do, like, she left it on the doctor's tent,
Instead of just a regular camp,
she
I
didn't leave it
think.
in the mess tent. She didn't leave it with Igor. She didn't leave it with Zale.
Oh,
She left it
God.
on the,
Of
she
the
left it
doctors.
on the swamp. My favorite line, which is actually, I think, kind of funny, is when Winchester's talking about gathering information and he's like seeing if anyone saw the mother in camp, and he goes, "I talked to everyone in camp," which, by the way, is a
It's a
first for
first.
me. Which
I don't know what else to say. The way DOS plays Charles this whole episode, chef's kiss. I love it so much. It's a first for me. It's like almost like non-romantically tsundere. You know tsundere? It's like, I don't like you. I just did this thing, for some other reason, not because I care about you. That attitude.
It is very sweet. I mean, everyone's great in this episode, but yeah, it was nice to see, like, just another side of David Ogden's, of, excuse me, of Winchester. It was nice to see that. So again, blend them all together. So, well, Essie, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for wanting to tackle, a difficult episode. It's an episode that's not regard again, like I said at the top of the show, even some of the MASH writers sort of admitted later on, yeah, that one didn't quite work the way we wanted it to, but it's certainly worthy of an in-depth discussion. And so thank you for coming on and talking with me about this.
Thank you for having me. I really do love this episode.
Good. Well, can you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
Yeah, so if you want to find me on Tumblr, I am a local human disaster on Tumblr with dashes in between local, human, and disaster. I had my Tumblr when I was 14. I think it still applies to me very well.
A wonderful handle for sure. Again, thank you so much for coming on, and I would love to have you back in later seasons if you are so inclined. So
I would love to.
thank you. Thanks everybody for listening. Of course, you can find all the back episodes of MASHcast on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can find me on Blue Sky under Rob Kelly Creative. And then finally, if you want to support the Find Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. There you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big salute to Dennis Bailey, Darrell Clark, James K, Michael Kelly, David Mann, Matt McLean, Lisa P, Brady Palmer, Joe Perino, Stan Peel, Michael Porter, Nicholas Prom, Adam Sanders, Stefan Van Schaik, Britt Schramm, Billy Shulman, and Mike Thomas. So again, thank you all for listening. We will be back next week, but until then, that is all.
Now, with that, you must have a complete personal history of all the involved parties. You have to have a letter from the chaplain. The company commander then recommends for approval or rejection.
He wouldn't dare. We'd hide his horse.